Yes, your house looks like a crack house, Kirsten, because of your cats.
Ha ha ha.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, episode 53, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction, books, reviews, and whatever else takes our fancy. Episode 53.
You want to say that once more?
I'm still a bit astonished. Hello, Kirsten, by the way.
Hello, Ian.
Are you a bit sick?
I am just incredibly, incredibly tired.
Why?
Because I've been trying to do 10 different things this month and I only had 1 month to do them in. But it is the end of the month today, and except for one thing that I won't get done today but will get done tomorrow, I'll then be done and I can have a whole day of not doing stuff.
What are the 10 things? Let's list them.
Let's not.
Okay.
Continue.
One of them was reading the books for this podcast.
One of
them.
That was one of them. And that is why we're late, because I apologize again. I texted Ian last week and said, I haven't read the books. Can we put it off for a week? So that's why this podcast is coming to you guys at the very beginning of April instead of in late July.
Okay, it's the very beginning of August, not April.
Oh, see, I'm so tired.
This is going to be a real coherent podcast because I'm never coherent anyway. I rely on you to really keep this thing going.
And I know, Charles, I know. Relax. Take a break. I promise you, the day after tomorrow, I am taking a break.
Why do you use the podcast and not, you know, email to discuss things with Charles about your work situation?
Oh, shut up. Just keep going.
Okay, so we're doing two books.
We are doing two books.
This was my decision.
Yes. Why are we doing these two books, Ian?
Because both of them are at the moment feature regularly, well, have been on the New York Times bestseller list.
Yes, I did look up, and I don't have the current figures, but as of December last year,
I have the
All The Light You Cannot See had been there for 82 weeks.
Oh, it's more than that now.
Well, obviously, because now it's July 2016, so it's been another 7 months.
So, as of publication
yes,
of this podcast, no, that's the wrong way of saying it, as of recording of this podcast, okay. So the date is the 31st of July 2016,
yes.
Just to date this podcast for years to come.
Mm-hmm. Now,
the New York Times bestseller list is broken up into different things. It's combined, there's hardcover, there's paperback. So
right. They're
not both on the same list at the moment, if that makes sense.
Okay.
The point being, on the hardcover list, so yes. The hardcover fiction list,
okay.
All The Light We Cannot See has been on there for 116 weeks.
Still in hardcover?
Yes.
Wow.
So people are still buying. It's number 8 on the hardcover list.
Wow.
Now, either there's a really small threshold for hardcover sales, which is possible. Like, you only have to sell about 30 to keep on the
list. Well, I imagine it's
but it is the
New probably
York Times
smaller
bestseller
than
list.
The paperback list.
Yeah, okay.
Because, you know, more paperbacks are printed, generally speaking, than hardcovers. It's not based on cumulative sales over the entire time of
publication. No, it's based on weekly data sourced from chain bookstores and independent bookstores, and apparently there's a secret source formula as well.
There is, because not every book that is sold everywhere gets calculated. There's a whole bunch.
Thus, there is controversy
arcane.
What we should do is spend most of the time discussing that controversy and who misses out.
Let's
and what
not.
This means about gatekeepers within, you know, Western civilization, but particularly the Eastern Seaboard of America, which basically runs publishing and knowledge in general.
Okay.
Anywho.
it's
number
right.
8.
You're right.
All the light. What?
You're
what?
Right, and they are valid points. And
are
I think
they?
I find it. I find it interesting actually that in, for example, in Australia, we are talking about the New York Times bestseller list, which, as you say, like, what actual impact should that have on us? You know, we're not talking about Australian bestseller lists. We're not talking about. Yeah, it's suddenly, you know, but the New York Times bestseller list has become this ubiquitous marker of
what would even be the Australian bestseller list that we would check?
You know, that's a really good question, and I'm ashamed to know that I don't know.
That's right.
Well, I know The Age publishes the bestseller list. I don't know exactly where the statistics come from.
Okay, well, I went with the New York Times because I'm a globalist.
It's the big one. Oh, if you're a globalist, I don't know that you'd go with the New York Times.
Why not?
Well, it's not global, is it?
Okay. True. It's
but anyway, let us continue.
It's number 8. In fact, Number 9 on the list is End of Watch by Stephen King. So it's already beaten. It's beaten Stephen King, who's been on there for 7 weeks.
Yeah. It is quite phenomenal that week in, week out.
116 of them.
This book.
And that would be from first week of publication because it would have been a bestseller from week one. So
From
day
possibly.
One, it's been on there. Paula Hawkins, on the other hand.
Yep. The Girl on the Train.
The Girl on the Train. It is on the hardcover list, but it's number 19, and it's not clear how many weeks it's been on there.
Okay.
It might be the same amount of time, but it is number 1 on the combined print and ebook fiction list, and it's been on there for 74 weeks.
74, okay. So still over a year on the bestseller list in some format.
Yes. So again, I repeat that. That's 74 weeks.
Yeah, that's quite a long time.
Yes. So again, would have been on – so the book's been out for a year and a half, essentially.
Yep.
So I thought, how about we read these? Because there is no other book that has been on, if I look at the combined, probably the closest to those two books is on both the combined and hardcover lists is The Nightingale by Kristen Hanna, which I've actually not heard of. Have you heard of The Nightingale?
No, I don't think so.
Guess what?
I was about to say yes, but I'm thinking of The Goldfinch.
No,
Donna
which
Tartt,
is it on
so.
Here? Now, yep. The Nightingale, there's a link here. The Nightingale is about two sisters in World War II, France. Hey! Who's struggling to survive in the countryside.
No one wants to read about
and guess
sisters.
What? The other one, guess what she does? She joins the resistance in Paris. Someone read All the Light We Cannot See. But I bet you
what are you saying?
So there's a 40-week difference. They looked at it and said, wow, that's been popular. Won a Pulitzer. Let's write that book. We'll just get rid of the German guy boy and we'll get rid of Von Rumpel.
Oh, so mean.
Is it Von Rumpel?
Von Rumpel.
Yeah. Let's get rid of him and we'll just focus on, two Paris girls in the countryside, one joins the resistance.
Okay.
What?
You're so mean.
The statistics are here. I'm just speaking facts. 71 weeks. And it's the only other book that's on the bestseller list that's, got the same sort of
so
length of time.
That author, what was her name?
Kristen Hanna.
Kristen Hanna.
Yeah, who is now suing this podcast.
Read All the Light We Cannot See.
44 weeks
as
ago.
As soon as it got published.
More or less.
I can imagine that this book will be a perennial bestseller. Yes. Therefore, I'm going to write a version of it myself.
Yes.
And her plan worked.
Well, apparently. Knocked it out real quick. So, anywho, I thought it would be interesting to read these because there must be a reason why these two books are still on the list.
Yeah, and
because Gone Girl's not there anymore.
No, look, I think, Gone Girl's a lot older.
True.
Not that much older, to be honest. But, I think with any sort of metric like bestseller lists, it's impossible to pinpoint exactly why. We don't know why. You don't know why Harry Potter became Harry Potter, and no one does. If anyone knew, that would be the end of publishing, really, because you'd just be writing these guaranteed bestsellers, and that's all that would ever be written. So you don't know. You can point to things that you suspect has made the book popular and has made a lot of people read it, but why that particular book stays on the bestseller list for 116 weeks as opposed to another one, I think that's, a lot more difficult to say. And a lot of it comes down to word of mouth. It comes down to which networks the book landed in to achieve that kind of word of mouth. It comes down to things like did book clubs pick it up? Did Oprah mention it? Did all of these factors come
into
it?
Well, Oprah, I don't think, had a show when All the
No,
We Cannot See.
Or the equivalent, right?
And the interesting thing about the Paula Hawkins, it's a UK novel.
Yes, yeah.
So it's obviously penetrated quite, well.
Oh, it's been published in like a dozen or more countries or something already. It's done quite well. But what I'm saying is that you cannot pinpoint these things based on the text alone. It's an impossibility. There's so many factors that go into achieving this kind of selling status that is, obviously the book itself has a lot to do with it, but there's so many other factors that are outside the book that contribute to this sort of phenomenon.
But it did win a Pulitzer. That is
it did
all,
win
oh,
a
now,
Pulitzer.
Sorry, I've gone to All the Light We Cannot
Which
See.
In itself would have contributed to its continued
It would have helped. And I'm
position.
Pretty sure it was longlisted for the National Book Award in its year.
And I think it also won the Carnegie Medal or yep. the Carnegie Fiction Prize, whatever that one's called. Correct. And was shortlisted for some others, obviously. I mean, yes, and all of that stuff obviously also contributes to, you know, keeping books
Can
on bestseller lists.
Do you know how many ratings it's got on Goodreads as of the July 31st, 2016?
I did not look. Let me guess.
Have a guess.
3,524.
Ratings?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. That's...
Is
yeah.
that ludicrously high? I don't really look at Goodreads.
Well, oh my God, okay.
I don't know.
371,604 people have given it a mark.
They've given it a rating or they've just
a rating
said
out of five.
They've just, wow.
A rating out of five.
Okay.
But more incredibly, just under, eight people under, 42,000 people have reviewed it. So they've actually put words in.
Wow, that's really high. I wouldn't have thought that many people would have reviewed it.
And actually, I can verify that. Well,
and I thought that's what you meant. I thought like people have actually given. Forgotten
a rating is out of five.
I'd forgotten you can actually just rate it rather than review it as well. Yeah. Okay. But still, I wouldn't have guessed 42,000. That seems incredibly high.
It happens to be the most looked at page on my blog. Wow. My review of this book by mile.
So this might be our most downloaded podcast and people will hate us.
Yes.
Oh, spoilers.
Well, if you've read my review, you know what I think of it. And
I didn't actually have time to read your review. No, so shall we get into the books?
Yeah, well, we're going to start with.
So let's start with All the Light We Can See.
But I just wanted to justify why we're doing this particular episode.
No, so it was not potluck, as it were.
Basically, so we can snub our nose at people who just read.
That's not true. Okay, that may have been your raison d'etre, but it was not mine.
As someone who only
and reads. I was actually read. I had wanted to read The Girl on the Tram for quite a while, and
because it's been so closely compared to Gone Girl.
I think that's part of it, and it just sounded interesting. But,
shame you read it then.
Spoilers.
All right, so All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Dower. I don't know how to pronounce it.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
I'm gonna because I've got Goodreads open. I may as well just use their book description. So.
Yes, go.
Is that all right?
That's fine. Sorry, was I looking at you funny?
Well, you often do, but was it a little bit funny? From the highly acclaimed... Oh, I'm not going to read any of that stuff. this stunningly ambitious instant New York Times bestseller about a blind French girl and a German boy whose paths collide in occupied France as both try to survive the devastation of World War II. What's interesting about just that sentence there is that's actually the end of the novel. Their paths only collide until the very end.
Yes.
That implication is that the paths collide,
but
you know,
they're together
for a good chunk of the novel, which they're not. Anywho, Marie Laure lives with her father in, or Laure, I don't know how.
Again, Laure.
Laure. Marie
no,
Laure.
No, 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 no. Laure.
Oh, my God.
Marie Laure.
I'm just going to say Marie. Marie. Okay. Marie lives with her father in Paris in the Museum of Natural History, where he works as the master of its thousands of locks. When she is six, Marie goes blind, and her father builds a perfect miniature of their neighborhood so she can memorize it by touch and navigate her way home. When she is 12, the Nazis occupy Paris and father.
Wow. Do we really have to give you this blow by blow?
All right. Basically, the book starts.
It's about Marie Laure and Werner.
Werner, yes. Who is a.
And they're both the same age, though.
Who joins the Hitler Youth, as you do, because he's good with radios.
He doesn't join the Hitler Youth. He goes to the school, which is. There is a slight distinction there.
Very, very, there very is. Fucking slight.
Yeah, absolutely. But there is. Because the book itself does position him in against the boys who are really Hitler Youthy.
Sort of.
Yeah.
Because his friend Frederick
I have issues with that kind of framing, but that is what the book is doing. The book is saying that Werner is not a Hitler Youth. Werner is not, you know, he's not really, you know, rah-rah Hitler, rah-rah motherland. He's
I know what the book is doing. I know what he's trying to, what Dawes is doing. He's saying, oh, this guy's so obsessed with his radios.
That's all he cares about.
That's all he cares. He's only, this is because it's an ability for him to explore radios and that even further. And he befriends Frederick, the one who's interested in birds, who gets the shit kicked out of him, literally.
Literally.
And you know, that shows, you know, and he doesn't get involved in all the other Nazi stuff that's going on.
Yeah.
He does pick up partisan stuff and they get killed as a result because he's interested in radios, Kirsten. He's interested in radios, all right?
He's
a fucking Nazi. I don't give a shit what anyone says, but he is, all right? Even if he may not, you know, hug Hitler.
There is and was a difference between German soldiers.
Oh, I know that. You didn't have to be a German soldier to be a Nazi. But he actually is put into the academy. He's put through the whole Nazi. He is atypical of everyone around him in that academy, okay?
Well, him and Frederick are atypical, you'd say.
Yes.
Because Frederick was sort of put there
conveniently
by.
Conveniently atypical.
Yeah.
Anywho. What we're talking about, the book, we might as well continue with my rant. No. Look, it's about these two, Verna and Marie.
Yeah.
Who are young, innocents caught up in war, in a sense.
That actually is, I think, the perfect way of encapsulating it, because that is the tone that the book takes as well.
It's what it wants us to do, because it's very clear. I mean, I think the whole book is manufactured from go to woe. It's just so much artifice in this book.
I think the overriding thing that I disliked about the book, and that prevented me from really, I guess, engaging with it on a story level, is that it's so damn pretty, you know? I mean, this subject matter, I think, was – I don't know that it should be that pretty. But it was, and I mean that in a stylistic way. You know, the way it was written, it's not it's really hard to describe. It's not quite twee, but there is a prettiness and a gentleness, I think, about the prose, and at times quite a purple hue, shall we say.
I think there's some beautiful writing here.
There is, but I think a lot of time it can stretch a little too far and even just be quite, you know, with the glittering starlit skies and it just can be a little, I guess, pedestrian.
But did you find it pedestrian?
Yeah, because of the metaphors and things, and yeah, I did. I didn't.
But did you find it readable?
Oh, it's readable. It's absolutely readable in terms of just line by line, page by page.
Because it is 530 pages.
It's absolutely readable. I felt the length. I think it's too long. It has more endings than Lord of the Rings, but I think it's one of the reasons, I think, why books like this get onto and maintain positions on the New York bestseller lists. I mean, not necessarily for 116 weeks. Is basic readability. You know, a book has to be accessible to a wide range of people with differing levels of reading experience and literacy and all that sort of stuff, you know, to be able to maintain that.
But one of the criticisms, not criticisms, but one of the concerns that was raised when the book came out was that it would go over the head of mainstream readers because there was too much poetry to the language.
I don't think there's I think that's what I mean about saying it's very pretty.
Also, it's not a linear narrative. It does dump you in at the bombing of St. Malo to begin with, and then jump
yeah,
back
sure.
In time.
But I think that's quite an elitist way of viewing the general public.
Yes.
Actually, to say that the general reading public, who are not college educated literary professors or what have you, can't follow a linear narrative, that they're incapable of, especially when the book is dated. Like every section gives you the date. So it's not as though you're just thrown in and you have to piece together the pieces yourselves of where this might be. And there are books written like that do demand that the reader themselves decode and try to understand without cues from the text how, where the storyline is taking place at what time. But All the Light We Cannot See doesn't do that. It very clearly delineates the time frames and where things are happening. So I think it's a perfect accessible thought. And for all of the sort of poetic nature of a lot of the prose, it's still incredibly accessible. And that's part of what I'm saying about, that there aren't really complicated sentence structures. There aren't, arcane references or things like that which would distance someone who hasn't got a huge reading experience behind them, for example.
And the chapters are very short.
Which is a commonly recognised way of, I guess, pacing your book. If you've got very short chapters, people tend to read a lot more in one sitting. But yeah, so in terms of accessibility, I think it very much is. And I don't think that poetic language means something is inaccessible. I think quite the opposite.
Okay. Look, I don't have a view. I just was interested in your view. I don't have a view on
that's
this one
view.
Way or the other. I'm more I just don't understand why this book is so popular.
I think because it takes this –
because it's not a particularly good love story.
It's not a love story.
Well, I think it's been – well, I just read the first sentence of the – it's got that whole star-crossed, fated lover aspect to it. I mean, From get go, you've got these two characters.
Yeah, and you know at some point their stories will intersect.
And that's what that if you're sympathetic to both of them, that's what you're cheering for. But it happens so late and so well. And it's so tied into the most stupid part of the novel, which is Von Rumpel.
Von Rumpel, yes.
And his search for, how do you pronounce it?
Von Rumpel.
And his Indiana Temple of Doom search for the diamond.
Yeah, the mystical, magical diamond.
Which will cure his cancer.
I don't know. It's like, what's that? It's like a MacGuffin that runs through the whole book. And it's, I mean, I see why it's there.
No, why is it there? Sorry, I've changed topic here, but let's get to it. Why is that there?
Well, that particular thing, I don't know. But there has to be something which sets up Mari and her father's flight to St. Malo.
The Germans are coming?
Well, no, why did they have to go there? They didn't have to go there. They went there to hand over this.
It had to be come on, there are other ways of doing that to make it sound less
absolutely.
Like it's an episode of Indiana Jones.
It could have been anything. Well, there was a lot of mysticism embroiled in Nazi ideology. So it does fall into that. It didn't have to – what I'm saying is – and why I'm saying it's kind of a MacGuffin is that there was no reason it had to be that particular thing. And I guess it has to be something of high value as well. So something that has an intrinsic high value but is small enough that you're just porting it around. I mean, didn't have to be, you know, like the massively expensive mystical blue diamond from wherever, but that's what he chose to use. So it's fine.
It's not like the plot needs it. I mean, Marie joins the partisans. That's pretty dangerous in and of itself.
Yeah.
It's not, you know.
But I get that needed to be something there that brings the Von Rumpel character after her.
Yeah, but he doesn't need to be in the book, is what I'm saying. I mean, the whole strand doesn't need to be there.
Yeah, yeah.
You could lift it. I mean, it feels like a completely different novel at times.
Yeah.
Especially when you get Von Rumpel's point of view and he's just literally, he's not figuratively, he's a moustache-twirling villain. I mean, he's got no hues to him at all. He's
very,
about as developed as...
Yeah.
This conversation at the moment. No, he's this conversation is more developed.
He's very caricaturish. And I guess there had to be some kind of mechanic in there for keeping Mari trapped in the house.
Or you could make your book 200 pages shorter.
Or you could make your book 200
and not have him.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. I didn't get – what was the point of this novel? What's this novel trying to say?
I don't know. Honestly, I did not love this novel.
Well, I know that, but sometimes when you don't love a novel, you're...
Well, this is what... Look, it's what I said to you before
recording.
I'm meh. I'm quite meh. I'd vaguely heard about this novel, but I hadn't really known about it at all until you recommended it. And I didn't even look stuff up until just this morning. So I had no idea it even won the Pulitzer. And I saw that and went, really? Pulitzer? Really? Okay. Because I don't know. I think the style of the novel runs counter to the subject matter that it's talking about, to the extent where we don't get a lot of the grittiness.
No, it avoids the grittiness.
You know, and even when we do get mostly aftermath sort of descriptions of bad stuff that's happened, it avoids a lot of the...
It avoids the war.
The viscera of it, I think.
Yeah, I really do think that Frederick and what happens to him is there to sort of replace a lot of the viscera of war.
Yeah, and look, to be fair, I mean, Mari and her family aren't in the middle of the war. They get involved in the resistance, but even and Mari herself doesn't get, like, she's not in the center of it. She's not doing stuff. She's tagging along with the the housekeeper's name.
Yep.
She's tagging along with her for the most part until the very, very end. So there's not a lot for her to... I was going to say to see. She is blind. There's not a lot for
her
to...
Which is the first time we've mentioned that, by the way.
Yeah, so there's not a lot for her to experience directly in that sort of theatre. And with Werner, he's also left to the side because he's in this elite little small group of soldiers who their job, because of Werner's expertise with radio and triangulation, is tracking down... people in the resistance who are broadcasting, and he's to the side of that. So he's not in I get you don't want to start saying things like the war proper, but he's not in the middle of the fighting.
But that is where it's also manufactured and deliberate, because Werner himself has his own conscience, which is his sister, who didn't want him to join and et cetera.
Yeah.
And he but he never really explores or interrogates what's happening to him and where he is, other than, oh, my God, they killed Kenny. They belted the shit out of Frederick.
Yeah.
You know, they never really, until the very end, where he sort of admits, yeah, maybe my sister was right, maybe this whole Nazi thing ain't so good after all.
Yeah, but I think that's understandable.
No, I don't. No,
you don't think there are people who are on the periphery of stuff who manage to convince themselves that they're just doing the job.
If he was just a German soldier who was conscripted into the war.
And don't forget, he's only a 14 and 15-year-old boy.
But he was in whatever you want to call it, Pitler Youth, whatever, the Institute, the Academy, yep. Whatever. He's absolutely head deep in this shit. I mean, it's all.
But he's even on
he's
the.
He's not just a conscripted soldier who once fought in the World War One and doesn't necessarily believe in Hitler, but he's fighting because he's a German and a German patriot. This is a guy. Who is there?
But he's on the periphery of it as well, like even in the academy, because he gets taken aside by the scientist who's looking into developing this technology.
That's my point, that it's all manufactured.
So he is taken aside.
Excuses, convenient and excuses
I agree
are
with
given
you. I agree with
to put
you.
Werner away from.
I agree with you. You are writing about a character with who you are as a conscious choice, as the author of this particular story, you're choosing a character who is on the periphery and therefore does not get immediately exposed to a lot of the the results of Nazism.
And even when his friend is kicked to shit, he doesn't decide then no way and runs off or finds a way to escape or that's how
because also it's not necessarily linked to the ideology in a way. I mean. You know, it could have been at any really harsh boys' school where the bully boys who decide the weak, effeminate boy who likes birds.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So none of this is – and I, that's
but
what you're saying.
But we're meant to feel sympathetic for a character who just goes with the flow, and other than his one unique knowledge of radios and shit like that, we're meant to feel sympathy for him and hope that he meets up with the blind girl at some point. I'm sorry to catchphrase it as the blind girl, because she's more than that.
Yeah.
Although I want to get to the blindness in a second. But, fuck me, no. It's just.
So I didn't feel. I can't say that I felt sympathy. I guess I didn't really feel either of these characters for the most part, although Marie-Louise was in some degrees done in a better way. They didn't feel like really fleshed out. Characters they felt like characters walking through the plot of this book,
which is my point. We're agreeing with each other.
Yeah.
That is precisely. But I'm just angry about it. I'm saying, well, he was an opportunity that's been missed.
So that's the
I noted a couple of reviewers said how well the blindness was portrayed in the novel. Though I dare say they're not blind themselves.
Because a lot of the time, and I did think, see, with
and I do want to mention just before you speak, because I don't know if I can comment on it personally, but there is a fantastic article about this.
Okay.
About the book on The Toast by Cherie Wells Jensen called On Blindness and the Portrayal of Marie-Laure in the All the Light We Cannot See, where she essentially takes it apart.
Yeah.
And is kicking up as a blind person. So, you know.
I suspected it wasn't well done, and part of what annoyed me actually is with Werner, you pretty much get Werner's story.
Yeah.
Is there one or two scenes from the point of view of his I can't remember the name, the scientist guy. Not Jutta, the sister. She at the very end she comes into it and gets her own couple of scenes and we can talk about that.
You've read it more recently than I have, so I'm not sure if the scientist
But there are not a lot of scenes, if any, of characters with Werner observing Werner. And there's a lot around Marie. We get scenes from her father, we get scenes from her uncle. I think there even might be some from the housekeeper, but I'm not sure. And I think a lot of the reason they're in there is because without them, Dora would be sort of robbed of the visual palette. And I would have regarded it as a much more interesting book if that were the case. And if there was no visual palette with Marie-Louise and it was everything was done via the other senses that she does have. And instead you have, and it was quite confusing to begin with when he first started doing this, because there were bits where I'm reading and because the tone of the book is, it has the feel of an omniscient narrator.
Yeah, no, that's true.
So it was, when he did first start switching between characters, it was a little difficult for me, although I may just have been tired, to pick up immediately. And there were bits where I'm thinking, he's describing visual stuff, but Mari wouldn't see any of this. And there is, oh no, this obviously must be from her father's point of view, and et cetera, et cetera. And I think maybe that was a way of circumventing the fact that because you have a blind protagonist, you can't write about all the visual stuff, which for humans who aren't blind is a massive part of our sensory input. And a massive part of the writing as well. There's a really good short story by Martin Livings, and I cannot remember the name of it, but it is in his collection. And it's a short story, but he is writing about a character who he's writing about blindness, because this group of people put out their own eyes as a sign of faith.
Yep, okay.
And he's done an excellent job of writing this story that is still rich in description and has a tactile quality to it without any visual cues. And it was a very, very good short story, and I'll look it up later and put it in the show notes. For the most part, this book doesn't quite seem to do it. Obviously, not being visually impaired myself, I don't know how well the practicalities of Mari's life were done.
He may have done his. He probably did do his research, and I'm not going to. I'm only raising it as that there is potentially an issue.
Sure,
here, but I can't.
Yeah. But practicalities aside,
I'll take my glasses off. I'm pretty rooted, but that's about it.
But practicalities aside, I did feel that her perspective was lessened because it wasn't entirely hers in her story. And it could have been. It really could have been. There was no need, I think, within the story to have the father's point of view or even the uncle's. I think it could have all have been Mari Lehrer's point of view, and it would have worked really well, and it would have given a much better, if it was done right, a much better, portrayal of a character who doesn't have the sense of sight and can't directly visually experiencing the world.
I liked her character more simply because she's more involved in the world she's in, even though she can't see it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Than Werner is.
Yeah.
Werner is on the periphery all the time. This is a girl who...
Werner is very much immersed in his own mind and his own obsession with electronics and radios.
But Marie's has...
I mean, that's really the core of his...
Okay, yeah. It's one note. That's
yeah,
the problem.
Yeah.
Whereas Marie has more than one note, and she gets involved in the resistance, and that's what is interesting. Mm. But that's the point. There's so many bits of this book that just don't come together, and on top of that there's a crazy guy looking for a diamond.
Yeah. I like the Indiana Jones reference. I hadn't thought of that.
Well, that's what didn't feel like it.
Yeah, no, now that you mention it, yeah, absolutely. I don't know why I didn't think of it.
And I just think, Pulitzer, like you, really?
I don't know. I think it was a readable book. I think it went on too long. There were bits which – and at the ending just didn't – like the – Marion Werner's ending.
Doesn't
sense. But the changeover with when she takes the little model house that has the diamond in it, and it's such this convoluted kind of thing where she gets him to take her down to the cave pool and throws it in the ocean, because that's the mythology of the diamond is that if anyone who has it will live forever, but everyone around them will come to misfortune, and the only way to sort of break the curse is to return it to the ocean, because the goddess who made it wants it back, kind of thing. Or that's where her lover is, so that's where it needs to go. So Mari goes and puts the house with the diamond in it in the ocean. It's like why she wouldn't have opened the little house and thrown the diamond itself into the ocean instead of just letting it float there on the tide pool. And to have to even ask Werner, is it in the ocean? Instead of she could have just thrown it in the ocean, and but then also to give him the key to access that place. I don't know whether she was telling him to. Was that a way of saying to him, "Well, you go get it"? But then, if she wanted to give it to him, why did she throw it in the? You know what I mean? Like the whole convoluted little skit just didn't make sense. And I thought she was going to throw it in the ocean. I thought that was great. But then, but obviously he, you know, the author wants this to end up with Verna. So that she can't happen. She can't throw the stone at the ocean because it would have been a near impossibility for him to have found it. Right?
There
so,
you go. There's the manufactured.
That's what I mean.
Convenient right? nature of this novel.
And that's
every
what I'm
element
saying.
Of it.
Yeah. Right. And then the book does this weird thing about hiding from you whether Verna knows about the diamond or not. Because he obviously he goes back, as I intimated, and he gets it and he takes it with him. And when he's killed, it's the little wooden house which Mari's father has made. Mari's father makes these models of
yes,
so she can study
so
the
Marie
model
can, and navigate her way through.
That's right. Yeah. They're like three dimensional maps, yeah. is what he's making for his daughter. It's a really clever idea. I like that a lot. I like the father making these really intricate wooden maps of the city so yes. his daughter could find her way around. And he makes little puzzle boxes out of some of the houses and hides things in her for her birthday and so on. So this is where this motif extends through the book. So Verna has this little wooden house and the book tells you, like at some point just before he dies or in those last pages, he notices that the house might open. So you think, okay, well, he's opened it then. And then when he dies, you know, like he gets blown up in a landmine and the house ends up years and years later where the government's going through, I guess, the possessions of those who were killed in the war and trying to get them back to families. It ends up with Jutta, his sister, who then ends up tracking down Marie Leur, who at that point is a well-respected scientist still in Paris, and hands her over the house. And throughout all of these extended endings of the book, you know, you're expected to be thinking up until the very end, oh, she's going to get the diamond. And, of course, when she opens it, it's not the diamond, it's the key that opened the access to the little tide cave pool thing where she threw it away. So then that means Verna went back in, got the house out of the water,
yeah.
saw that it opened it, took out the stone, presumably threw it back into the ocean, replaced it with the key after he locked and carried that around with him. And why would
Well, and because he knew she wanted to get rid of the stone, but not
yeah,
necessarily the house.
I know.
But why didn't she take the stone out of the house?
But the thing is, why would we not know that?
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
why manipulate the reader with this art, as you say, this artificiality of the suspense yeah. of whether the diamond's there when it doesn't actually make sense? Like if Verna had never noticed that the house opened, you'd go, okay. But then you couldn't have the ending because if he'd never noticed it had opened, the diamond would still be in there. And, you know, it's just this convoluted little series of things for, as you say, around this diamond, which I did. Why? Why? I don't know. I liked some parts of the book.
I think the opening's good. I think the first third's. And I do like, there is this, it's a bit on the nose, but this idea that. She sends messages for the partisans.
Yeah,
he receives messages as a radio guy. It's a bit on the nose, but it's not that link is nice. But oh my god, they're
well, and you're getting this idea that
they're vanilla characters. It's very much a vanilla,
also,
a vanilla look at the war. You're right. There's no grittiness, no visceral.
No,
and it doesn't, we don't have to have guts
and
gore. But
no, but also from like okay, so at the end when Mari is up in the attic room because she's hiding from Von Rumpel, who's come to actually that music should play every time he appears. You know, on page, you should turn a page and there's a little chip in the book which goes, dun, 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 dun. and they could do that with an e-book really easily.
Absolutely.
Anyway, so she's hiding up there for like 3 or 4 days or something like that with almost no food and very minimal water. And of course, there's this coy little mention at the very end that, oh, there's a bowl of urine over there that she's bearing in mind that she is blind. So visual stuff is gone. So other senses take the place that there's no real description
the stench of herself and
the smells that are going to be in the room, how she smells, how the room smells, how, you know, how the floorboards must be scraping her skin after those days. And she must be getting really achy from just sleeping on the floor. And like all of these sensations in this situation of, you know, quite extreme physical deprivation, then they're not really conveyed. And to some extent with Werner and his compatriots who were trapped in the rubble of the basement of the hotel where they're at when this attack happened. I mean, there is, you know, obviously, yes, one of them is badly wounded and he dies and you know, they have, again, no water and no food. But
it all feels like it's been done on a Hollywood set. It feels manufactured.
In fact, I did not realize they were in there for so long.
That's right. Yeah.
Because you know, the book at some point does say it's been four days or something.
That's right.
And you go, 4 days? And then the big guy who's had no food or water or was barely moved suddenly is able to get up and start moving rocks out of the way and walk down. It's just
adrenaline.
It's really
adrenaline.
I don't know. Yeah. And that's what I mean. Like, I'm not, like, when I say, you know, the visceral quality is not there, it's not that I want this story to be told from the middle of combat. It's just the way it is told, the situation that it's in, that's not conveyed, I think, with the level of, I guess, sensory and visceral detail that it should have. And like I said, it's so pretty. We're not going to talk about a blind girl stuck in an attic getting sweaty and stinky and pissing in a bowl, and no mention of defecation, which, you know what I mean, like it's pretty.
There was a bowl for that, it just wasn't mentioned.
That's what I'm right.
Shit smeared bowl next to the urine bowl.
Exactly. No mention of Werner in his underground thing, like pissing his pants, because, you know, like there's no.
And then people say it's not meant to be that type of book.
Yeah.
And I say to that, well,
the subject matter. And then, oh my God, I almost forgot.
Wait, this is the person who said I was meh about the book and I have nothing to say about it.
Yeah.
Keep going.
But, you know, listen to how cheery my voice is. That might be the sleep deprivation.
You're hallucinating.
I really didn't hate the book. But then you have that scene at the end, like one of the endings, when it
in the Shire.
When for the first time in the whole book, we get a chapter that's from the point of view of Jutta, who is Werner's sister. And she's in Berlin with a couple of other women.
It's set in the 70s or something.
A couple of other girls. No. At the end of the war. When the Russians come through.
Oh, sorry, when the Russians, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
How could you forget that chapter?
Yeah.
So the Russians come through, two or three young Russian infantry soldiers, I guess, who are part of, like, taking over Berlin after the war is in the middle of its, like, it's in its death throes. And they're described in such awful physical ways. And they rape Jutta and the two girls who are with her, I think one of whom is like 12 or something, and the woman who's taking care of these girls.
See, that's your grittiness. There you go.
But that scene is not written it's written in the same sort of way that the rest of the book is. And I was like, oh, really? So you're going to write this whole book and you're going to neatly avoid a lot of the horrors of war, but we've still got to get the rape in.
Got to get the rape in for a character.
The rape of women, by the way,
yeah.
Not the rape of any, you know, boys or young men, which is very common in wartime, but that's pushed aside. And it's not.
But also of a character who doesn't even play a major role in the book.
This is the first time we get her point of view. The first time we get Jutta's point of view.
I shouldn't be laughing.
Is her being raped.
Yeah, that's great.
Actually made me very angry. It's like, are you fucking kidding me? It's like, well, we need to bring her in because we need to show that girls were raped in the war by the Russians. By the Russians. The evil Russians. Not the nice Germans that we've been reading about. You know, and that.
Well, no, they hurt Frederick. I mean, just don't forget Frederick.
But, you know, it just seemed completely unnecessary in a book which was bending over backwards to avoid the conventional horrors of war, shall we say?
If they'd mentioned the shit-smeared bowl, would you have accepted the rape?
No. <Okay. laughs> But you know what I mean? Like, it was an unnecessary addition.
Right. Oh, I think it's not an unnecessary book, but it's 116 weeks on a bestseller list. So.
And the other thing, actually, sorry, just one more thing.
Oh, no, yeah, go ahead.
Because the other thing which did – it puzzled me because As we, I think we alluded to at the beginning, the book is not a straight linear narrative. It's cut up into sections. So we start at the beginning of the bombardment of
the planes are literally letting go of their payload.
At St. Malo. Yep. And we cut back to the childhood of both Marie-Leur and Werner.
Yep.
And then we cut forward to episodes leading up to the war, and it goes back and forth. And it's very easy to follow, and it's very clearly flagged. But it did have this unusual effect, at least for me. I don't know if you experienced the same thing, Ian, but at least for me, it was it served to undercut any possible suspense in the book, because you got told these things, like where the characters had ended up at this particular point, what was sort of happening to them, and then you got told like earlier parts. But those earlier parts, which would have, I guess, in a more linear narrative or in a narrative that was cut up in a different way, had provided you with tension because, oh, here's Von Rumpel, he's coming, and is he going to get there, and is this going to happen? But you know it happened.
Yeah.
So then it's just a case, well, here's how it happened, and most of the time the how is not interesting.
Yeah.
Like, it's not interesting. So that the particular way this book was structured,
I didn't have the same feeling because I was completely disengaged with the general narrative of the novel anyway.
But that might have been part of it, though, because part of what keeps you engaged in a book, part of,
although I did finish the book, so people would argue, well, you couldn't have been that disengaged.
Well, I had to do it for the podcast.
No, but I read it before the podcast.
Oh, that's true. I don't think I would have finished this book on my own. I think I would have stopped. Because part of the engagement is following through the story. And in a book like this where you are past, present sort of thing, is like the expectation of what might happen. But when you know what's happened, you're reading these past scenes and going, well, okay, yes, I didn't know precisely how Von Rumpel, but okay, yeah, obviously he would have got there because we know he got there. Obviously this happened because we've seen that happen, and now you're telling me why, and the why isn't even interesting or unusual.
And that's the thing. Many books do the same thing, but the why
is interesting.
Well,
or yeah, you really can't understand how this situation could possibly have happened.
Correct.
You know, so and I thought, I don't know. Yeah.
I finished it when I didn't, I could have given it up because I didn't do it for the podcast because I'd read it beforehand. Partly because the chapters are very short tend to
it
just swallow
readable.
Them down. And it is very readable, but I can't say I was.
No, I was not.
Engaged in that in a deep sense that you can engage in.
Absolutely not. And yeah, there are bits I liked, but not enough of those bits that I was interested in.
On the contrary, and here's a segue, I would have stopped reading The Girl on the Train if not for the podcast. In fact, what I would have done is just flicked to the end
just to confirm what you already knew.
Which I'd figured out 400 pages beforehand and gone, yep, that's what it turned out
to be.
And done. Yes.
Yeah.
Wow, that's
okay, so
yes.
The Girl in the Train by Paula Hawkins.
You want to describe it?
Yes, okay. So The Girl in the Train.
Which, let me just say.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Remember.
Yeah, okay. 42,000 reviews.
Yes. Guess how many reviews. Guess how many ratings.
Oh, ratings. That was
okay,
700
so
and something,
the
right?
Anthony Doerr was 300,000 and something.
Oh, 300,000, right. Yeah. I don't know. 258,000.
Which is the sort of figure I would have gone with.
Yeah.
It's just under 700,000.
Right. Okay.
So this has been a more popular book, even though it's.
Well, it's a book that attracted more ratings on Goodreads. That doesn't necessarily mean.
Okay, 68,000 reviews.
Because, you know, then you have to work out the number of people who are on Goodreads and do the Venn overlap between the people who've read the book.
I'm
and maybe the people who read All the Light We Cannot See don't do Goodreads. And, you know, so you can't make.
They do Goodreads because they're on the. Oh, you mean the other. Okay, gotcha.
Yes, right.
68,000 people have written a review.
Wow, so more. Which, you know, I guess. I think this book has the potential, unlike All the Light We Cannot See, to maybe be a bit more polarizing. So often a book that is polarizing will attract more commentary. I can't imagine, you know, there'd be a lot of people who absolutely hate All the Light We Cannot See. You know, I think it's such an inoffensive book that
you really
be,
think it's inoffensive.
All the Light We Cannot See.
All the Light We Cannot See.
Yeah,
oh,
that's
sorry.
What I'm saying. I think All the Light We Cannot See. Yeah. I think is such an inoffensive book.
Well, no, I think it's.
It's inoffensive. It's inoffensive in itself. Might be offensive.
I think its treatment of Nazis is a bit.
But the people who you know, I anyway.
And you might think differently when you read the article about the blindness.
I'm not saying that people can't take it absolutely, but I
on
think
the face
overall,
of it, yeah, I see what you're saying.
Right, overall,
The Girl on the Train, you're offended pretty much.
I think it's more polarizing, so I think that might attract more reviews. I don't know what's its average rating though. Like, does it break down the number of reviews?
Yeah.
How many bad reviews were there?
No. Oh, yeah. No, it does. It does. Yeah. It's 5.4s. Most people have given it.
Right. Okay.
And I think what is it? It rates a 3.85. So it's on the high threes. So
okay.
The way Goodreads, three is I liked it. Four is it was really good. And five is I lost my jizz myself.
I have nothing bad to say about this book.
Yeah. Every time I see it, I.
Okay,
have a wank.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
What? That's what five means. A good.
That's what five. That's the
description. If you come into the meta code,
every time I see it, I have a wank.
That's what the medico says.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, in Goodreads. Okay. Anyway,
that's
so the girl.
There are some sticky Kindles out there, aren't there?
The Girl on the Train by Paula Hawkins is about a girl.
I thought I was telling you
she's
what
more
it was
a woman,
about.
Really, but I suppose that's a sexist.
Oh, can we get into this a bit later, though? Because okay. I have a thing about the fucking girls. But anyway.
Okay. All right.
No, so, okay, yeah, so The Girl on the Train. So it's essentially, I guess, like All the Light We Cannot See, you have a split narrative, which is divided between three different characters.
Yep.
These ones are all first-person characters. I don't think we mentioned All the Light We Cannot See is all, they're all third-person
narrative
strategies. The Girl on the Train, they're all first-person narrations. Not that different either. Anyway, we'll get to that. And so the central character, the eponymous girl on the train, is Rachel, who has been divorced from her husband, who has remarried and had a child with the woman he had an affair with while he was married to Rachel. And she has descended into alcoholism and lost her job, but still goes to the city on the train every day because she's staying with a woman who she doesn't want to know about her unemployment status. So she goes in the train and she, the particular line she's on, it stops almost every day for an extended period of time at this signal, which happens to be opposite her old house that she lived in. And a few doors down, she sees this couple who come out to their deck, and she sees them, and they're a very physically attractive couple, and she makes up names for them and constructs this little fantasy of who they are, essentially. And that's kind of part of what gets her through the day, I guess. So that's her sort of story. And then one day the woman who she's looked at on the train goes missing.
But before that, two things happen. One is that she sees that woman with another man on the deck.
Yes,
which
she
is
does.
Critical. And two is that Rachel loses time.
Yes, because, well, I was getting to
Were you getting to the guy on the deck, the other guy on the deck?
Well, I was – well, I – my God, you're so – I was going to say, so one day the woman on the deck who she thinks of as Jess goes missing.
And her real name.
No, at this point we find out her real name is actually Megan Hipwell, and her narrative begins to come in, into the book as a first-person segment. The reason why Megan's going missing is such a huge schism in Rachel's life is that, A, she saw a man, she saw her the day before she's gone missing with a strange man, kissing a strange man on the deck, and this infuriates Rachel. And the other thing is that Rachel is an alcoholic and quite a hardcore alcoholic. She drinks on the train every day on the way home and sometimes on the way there and at home and at other times, and she suffers blackouts. And she cannot remember what happened on the Saturday night that Megan went missing, except that she woke up on the Sunday morning with fairly serious injuries on her head and blood, and knowing something really, really, really bad happened. And the day before, when she'd seen Megan kissing the strange man, which had shattered her fantasies of this dyad, she'd gotten so angry because essentially that was transference for the marriage that she wished she'd still had. She'd gotten so angry, she actually kind of said, if I saw her right now, I would kill her or something to that effect. So the book is kind of setting up, but not successfully.
Really poorly.
That maybe Rachel did something to Megan, but when she's gotten that blind, blackout, drunk, you go, there's no way she...
That's right.
Abducted and or possibly killed and or hid the body of a strong young woman who was not blind, blackout drunk.
Given what she did see and then forgot, only to be reminded very late in the novel.
Yeah.
So given all that, there's no way she could have been competent to be so drunk to have, to have forgotten critical things. There's no way she couldn't – I don't believe she could walk. I mean, murder
that's
someone.
That's what I mean, right?
It's this idea that drunkenness, someone puts you in this sort of schizoid way where you're
– Because the thing is, if Megan had just been found like dead, battered in the street,
you
might go, maybe Rachel did it. But no, she's abducted and she's not found for weeks. And you think, well, no, this is not –
There's a methodical nature to the way she was killed.
So if she was killed even right there and then and Rachel did it, at some point Rachel has then, managed somehow in her blind blackout state.
To deal that sort of blackout drunkenness as if you are a separate person in a separate body who's methodically able to do higher level functioning things.
But that's if.
I mean, there are high level function drunks, but usually they're not in the middle of a blackout.
But also, sure, but that's also supposing, and I couldn't make up my mind whether the book was trying to get us to think that maybe Rachel did it, because I just could not believe that at all. So I thought, well, maybe the book isn't trying to get us to think that.
That she's not a raging alcoholic?
No, that she didn't do anything to Megan. And so the mystery of the book is just that what did she see? So I can't make up my mind.
No, it's clearly trying to make us think that it's a red herring, absolutely.
Well, then it's such a bad job, because there's no way that could have happened.
And in fact, if you watch the movie preview of this,
right?
Because it's now been turned into a movie set in the US, not the UK,
right? Well,
that's the line in the movie that she may have committed the murder, because she's been she's been questioned by the police and all that.
Yeah, but dismissed.
It's
pretty
a stronger element. Yeah, but it's a stronger element in the trailer that I saw.
Now, in fact, from the beginning, the police are just really wanting to know what she did.
Well, the female cop hates her, but then all the women in this book hate each other.
That's the thing which made me so sad. And I say sad and not angry, because just putting it out there, I'm glad it's not just me, because female collaboration is sort of the point of the thesis that I'm doing, and I'm looking at the lack of collaboration and cooperation and by also friendship between female characters in – I'm looking at fairy tale narratives, but it's a wider problem. It's a huge problem.
You can now reference this book.
Well – and so I'm wondering, is this just my filters picking this up?
No, it isn't.
There's not a single...
Everyone.
And the two women who are in sort of, I guess, in a helpful matrix with other female characters are pitiable. So you've got Catherine, who is the woman who has allowed Rachel to come and live in her spare room.
But she clearly doesn't like Rachel. I mean,
She doesn't, though. She threatens to, because Rachel... It's Catherine. Oh my God. I think one of the things the book did well, or at least one of the things I was able to take out of the book, was even though we never get Catherine's perspective, it was like, I so got Catherine's perspective. Can you imagine that day she's coming home, she's spent the night with her boyfriend, and she's come home to, and she knows her flatmate's an alcoholic, and she just feels so sorry for her. She doesn't know she's lost a job, doesn't know she's been lying to her for months, but she feels really sorry for her, and she's offered this woman a place in her home, in her spare room.
She vomited on
And she comes home and there's like this pile of piss-soaked clothes right in front of the door. Where Rachel has just come home and like undressed and left it there, and then there's vomit on the stairs, and her alcoholic flatmate is still in bed, and it's like, no wonder she lost it and said, "This is it, you've got to go, I can't do it anymore." it's like I felt so much for
Catherine. And in the text, through Rachel's point of view, she goes, "Oh yeah, I forgot, I fell asleep. Oh no, but the vomit's still out there."
But to be fair to the book, I think the depiction of that. Of the effects of that kind of alcohol addiction, that and to that extent, is really well done, and the to and fro of it. So I've been clean for a day. It's I'm going to be really well, and I've got this new thing to do, and then 2 days later, so I'm just going to have a drink of wine. That this toing and froing, and I think the mindset of I've not had a substance abuse problem, but we have other issues. But I think the mindset of that dependence on a substance, and that pull and repulsion of that addiction was really well done. And
was it? Do you really think it was really well done?
I do think, because it was never easy. And she's even by the end of the book, she's not done with that. That's still a problem. That's a problem. It will always be a problem. There's no quick fix to it. Even at the point, and I got a little worried where she starts getting obsessed with Megan's missing person case, and she's going, "I haven't even drunk for 2 days, and this is great," because she's transferred the alcoholism with this other obsession, and I thought, "Oh God, don't let her give up alcohol."
No, that's the point. But she doesn't come right back. Yeah, but each time she then gets back onto alcohol later in the book, it's always triggered by men.
Yeah, I'm not.
And it's not. She just wants a drink. She goes, "Oh, I've got to go and see." So Megan's,
I need a drink.
Megan's,
That is what it does.
Yeah,
you're that addicted to a substance, no matter what the substance is, you get to a point, and this has been going on for months, years even, because this happened before her marriage broke up, her alcohol problems, right? You get to the point where you need alcohol just to function. Not to get drunk, not to feel good, just to function.
No, I understood.
So actually that point where she's got to go and see the woman who her flatmate has set up for a job interview with.
I just don't want to give this book any credit.
And she's saying, you know, I need to have a drink to get through the interview. It rang so true because that's it.
I just don't
want to
give this book any credit.
But I think you do. Okay, and fine. I think the depiction of alcoholism.
Okay. Who's the other, but just, who's, you said there was.
Oh, so the third character is Anna, who is.
No. We'll get to Anna in a second. Who's, you said there were two women who were.
The other.
Sympathetic to other women in there.
Oh, there's.
Because her mum turns up, but literally for two pages.
Yeah, it might just have been her mum. It might just have been her mum who gives her some money. That might have been the other one I noted.
But all the main characters.
The main characters hate it. The women but on site hate each other.
And the third person, the third woman.
So the third woman is Anna, who is the ex-mistress and now wife of Tom, who is Rachel's ex-husband.
Anna?
Yeah.
Her babysitter for a period was Megan.
You know, ended up having an affair with Tom, who, let's spoil this fucking book, who killed Megan.
Yes.
Right?
And that is...
So it's all of the... It's this
net. When did
net.
You pick it? When did you pick it?
Probably halfway through. And I have to say, when I read period, but especially when I read... What? especially when I read mysteries or thrillers, yeah. I really consciously... And it's the same with movies and everything. I consciously try to shut down that part of my brain... Which wants to work out what's happening.
It wasn't
because part of the movie and the book and these kinds of stories, like that's part, the reveal is part of the joy of it, right? So I do consciously try to, I know a lot of people go into this type of book and movie trying to work out from like what's happening, who could have done it, what's the story like. I don't. So when I saw The Sixth Sense all those years ago, I was genuinely like, oh my God, they're all dead, you know, and that was a joy and it's part of the movie. So what I'm saying is that a book or a movie which is using that type of a structure and that type of a plot has to be doing it in a very clumsy way for me to pick it up early because I consciously try not to even think about
that
it.
I'd pick it
up about halfway through, I think.
And you couldn't help it because it's just so...
It just becomes like, I mean, I think, I don't know that it could have been possible not to pick it up because she does a decent line in dropping the hints about Tom not being a nice guy. It's quite good. Very early on, like Rachel remembers how she wasn't meant to touch Tom's computer because she messes things up. And I thought, oh, that's a bit controlling. And she kind of fobs it off with because, oh, she always does mess it up. She always loses files and stuff. And so she's not meant to touch it. It's like, well, why doesn't she have her own computer? That seems a bit controlling. So, but it's little things like that she did to try to set up Tom as not being what he assumed.
But that was so obvious. But also the one where Megan, Megan through her own eyes thinks of Tom as someone who's not bad to look at. And there's a couple of references to that and you think, yeah, all right.
And again, you have the problem with these kind of books where...
clearly he's a philanderer.
Well, that doesn't mean he's a murderer.
No, true. But
ladies.
No, but I actually thought we would find out that Tom did... Stuck Megan, but that was another red herring. It would be something else.
Yeah.
I thought, well, it's clearly Tom, but it's not going to be Tom because that's too obvious.
Yeah. Again, you have a closed ecosystem.
Yeah. That's the other
So unless the book is going to, or, you know, whatever the story is, not even this particular book, unless it is actually going to throw in a completely unknown stranger, which, let's face it, on a narrative level, would be very unsatisfying as a reader. Right. If at the end it's like, oh no, it was just this dickhead from that we've never heard before, it was a random nutter who grabbed her and killed her. Like you'd go, what the fuck? You know, it wouldn't satisfy.
And it is a close.
Which is
literally five people.
Which is a really interesting discussion to have in itself.
Yeah, true.
But also, let's face it. Most of the time, when women are killed, it is by someone they know and trust. It is not a stranger in the street.
But there is. You're right. It's a closed ecosystem. There's about five or six.
So therefore, you've got your suspects, right?
Yeah.
You've got her husband Scott.
Yeah.
You've got the psychiatrist Abdich,
yeah.
Dr. Abdich, Kamal Abdich. You've got him, and you've got Tom. They're your three.
And Rachel, if you believe that.
Well, but you don't ever
and
believe
I think
Rachel,
she
right?
Just she does try to manipulate it slightly. You think Anna...
Maybe Anna did it. I guess so. But again, I think the character of Anna's drawn so well. Because the thing is, you are inside these three women's heads. So it can't be any of them, except Rachel, because she can't remember shit. But otherwise...
Unless it's completely unreliable.
Otherwise, if the book is faithful, it can't be Anna.
Yeah.
Right?
No,
and Megan can't have run away, right?
True.
So they aren't the options. Because you've known these women from the inside. I'm not saying the book couldn't have cheated. Books do that. This book cheats, but not in that way. So you've got these suspects that you've been given almost like in a police lineup It's like, well, which one is it? How can we discount them? And the book plays with emphasizing their possible culpability at various levels. So you get different sides of their characters through the different perspective of the women and so on.
But
that doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing.
No, it doesn't. I mean, well, in a sense, you have to wait for everyone else to catch up.
Yeah.
And there is still the level of suspense because you think, well, I might be wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
She might pull something really smart out of her head and shock me. But, yeah, anyway, but the end of the day, what just got me was just the vile hatred. I mean, it's been compared to Gone Girl, okay?
I can see that. Well, you've got a missing woman
unreliable narrators, but also people who who detest each other. And one woman who detests her husband so much, she's willing to fake her own death and ultimately kill herself as part of that because, you know, Gone Girl.
I thought you were talking about the girl on the train. I'm thinking, what the fuck, did I miss that? No. That was fucking subtle.
Just to get back at a philandering husband.
Yes.
Though, it doesn't have the same sort of smarts because there's
– No.
Well, I have issues with Gone Girl, but Gone Girl has some really smart stuff going on in the engine room. This has nothing smart.
No, and the ending was ludicrous.
Oh, how they take Tom down?
Yeah. It was – and it made no sense. So, okay, first –
you don't want to talk about how much they hate each other? You want to just get straight to the ending?
Well, this goes into the ending, right? So first of all, okay, one of the big physical cheats is that, and it's so carelessly done, it made me very cross from a craft point of view, is Megan and Tom have these, spare phones. They're probably burner phones that they have used months and months ago because their affair is well over by the time Megan dies. But they've had these phones that they haven't used for a while. And Anna finds Tom's phone in his gym bag and it's dead because it hasn't been used for ages. But she finds a charger and charges it in. And that's how she finds out he's having an affair. Doesn't know who with at that point, but finds out, he must have been having an affair because there's these texts about meetings and stuff. Megan, in her house, at the end, because she's pregnant and she thinks it might be Tom's, goes to get her phone to contact him and it's working. It's like, why? Why would her phone, which she hasn't used for months, be working? Why wouldn't it be dead as a fucking doorknob when we've just seen the exact same thing happen two chapters before?
Well, she's just conscientious to keep a charge.
No, but she wasn't. It's just in a bag. It's not you know, in fact, she even hopes, like, oh, I hope the phone's still got some charge in it after all this stuff. Oh, look, it does. How lucky. It's like, fuck off. Like, why would you, why do that? You know, I get she needed it. Why do that? Because you can't have her using her own phone because then there would have been evidence for the cops when she died that she texted Tom. So you can't have that. So she's got to use a burner phone. And it's too convoluted and she doesn't have time at the particular moment to charge her own phone. And, you know, so there's – but find another fucking way around it. It's so clumsy and it made me really cross. But anyway, that aside. So the ending where Rachel finally remembers, which is a difficulty because that's not – like memory doesn't work by unearthing stuff that's locked away. We reconstruct our memory. So the fact that she reconstructs something which may or not be true is kind of not addressed in the book. It's revealed as, the unveiling. She's finally unearthed those memories.
It's all a domino thing. She remembers that she didn't do the golf club bit.
Yes.
And then it just becomes a domino. Yeah.
And to be fair, some of those memories are memories she's already had and then she kind of looks at them in a different way and puts pieces together. So she realised that Tom has actually been physically abusive, certainly mentally abusive during their marriage, but only during her blackouts or her drunken times so that he could then say, oh, you didn't remember.
That's what the book says.
Yeah, right.
So he only belted the shit out of her when she was drunk.
Or was abusive to her while he was drunk, right?
Yeah.
But she puts the pieces together, decides it must have been Tom who killed Megan, goes back over to the old house where Tom and Anna are still living, which, by the way, is a beautiful little piece of emotional abuse done by Tom to keep his new wife in the house where he was, where she doesn't want to be.
Yeah.
To keep her there by telling her, well, we'll make a lot of money. We'll lose a lot of money if we sell the house. We have to stay here. We can't afford to move.
Yeah.
And then also to be telling Rachel that, Anna loves the new house. She wanted to stay here. We can't move. Anna wants to. So he's playing these two women's insecurities and discomforts against themselves.
Yeah.
For his own psychological satisfaction, I guess.
But yeah, you guess, because we don't really get much into
Tom's. I think it's pretty clear by the end that Tom must be a sociopath.
He's a sociopath because he's alive.
So this is why,
everything.
Right? So this is who Tom is that we find out. And okay, I have I have a little issue with like the bright, intelligent Machiavellian sociopath who no one can even sense there's a slight thing wrong with him at all times. Right? At all times. Not just for the few hours he's putting it on for this particular thing he's doing, but at all times.
Yeah.
But, you know, neither woman will marry to him for like a decade or anything, so maybe the cracks haven't yet begun to show. I can give the book a little leeway there. But anyway, so Rachel goes to Megan and Tom's house to Anna and Tom's house to sort of rescue Anna and her child to get them away from Tom.
Well, to the child in particular.
The child in particular, I guess.
She gives a shit
because
about
that's
Anna.
The other thing. One of the reasons she turned to alcohol and her marriage broke down was that she can't have children.
Well,
she couldn't conceive.
Being a mother is the key thing in the whole novel.
And can I just say how – and not – like talking about this book in particular, because yes, this book has very good reasons and blah, blah, blah. But can I say how sick I am of this trope?
No, but it made me angry.
You know,
that it's all about motherhood. But not just, okay, women, men, we all want to be, some of us want to be parents. Yeah. Parenthood is, I'm a parent.
Yep.
It's lovely, whatever. But the fact that they're just so slavishly obsessed with the idea, all of them, all three to the point of as if to say, that's it. Your life cannot be fulfilled without a child.
Yeah. Or the idea of having children and then losing a child is – and it is this horrible tragedy.
It is a horrible tragedy. I know
but
that.
But something that can't ever be gotten. I mean, this
yeah,
is –
yeah, the Megan could never
recover
from what she did.
This is the narrative that is present in this book. And I'm saying it's not just this book because it's hard to point at one thing because – the book itself has its own internal logics, right? But it is a trope that's repeated over and over and over.
No, but it's annoying, motherhood
is the be-all and end-all of womanhood, that if you don't have children, because
Megan is a broken person because her child died in the bath with her. Rachel is a broken person because she could never have a child.
Yep.
And Anna's a broken person because
she's obsessed with her child.
Correct. All three connected to. And there was a point in the book where Rachel, I think, is thinking about, well, you know, we're all connected as being mothers and that. And,
and you think,
oh, fuck off. Fuck right off.
I do get quite tired of this being the dominant narrative.
There is internal logic. It makes sense.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean it's fucking something that should be promoted.
But, you know, people will say, oh, but for some women who can't have children, it is the end of the world. And for some women who lose their children in infancy, it is the end of the world.
There is no other perspective in this book.
This is what I'm saying. But not just even in this book. But in the wider culture, and this is a problem, this book is emblematic of this narrative about motherhood and tragic motherhood to boot.
And none of the men seem to give a shit too much.
No, exactly. Fatherhood's not, well, Scott really does want a child. He's quite devastated when he finds out Megan was pregnant.
But there you go. Scott is devo.
Mm.
Tom doesn't seem to give that much
Tom's
of a shit.
Tom's a sociopath.
And the boyfriend of Megan who ran off.
We don't know, but that might have been his coping mechanism.
But the point is that there's no man, none of the men are as obsessed, except for Scott, as the women who
are
depicted in this book.
Obsessed. Let's face it. He's not obsessed with having a child.
The point being, you get different sort of perspectives of the men. Not that they're I mean, one of the strengths is that the women are the voices in this book. It's also the major weakness because as voices, they just fucking hate each other.
They're
obsessed with things.
Yeah. And it's not, as you say, it's not just that they – because, you know,
Anna hates Rachel.
Yeah.
Anna hates Megan.
Yeah.
Megan doesn't know Rachel.
But, you know,
because she's dead.
As soon as Megan becomes a real woman and not the fantasy projection,
Rachel hates Megan. Correct.
You know, it's and even, like, as I said, the one sort of helpful relationship that's in there, which is Catherine and Rachel, Rachel pities Catherine.
Yes.
You know, she really does. She doesn't like Catherine. And she thinks Catherine
is pitiable.
Well,
it's made clear that Catherine was an old friend from college who she hasn't seen in years but happens to be in the neighbourhood, so she went and is staying with her. So she doesn't like her.
And she kind of – and she she thinks she's pitiable for allowing
Well, they pity each other, frankly.
It's
mutual pittiness.
So it's a really sad dynamic that runs through this book. And, yeah, like even to the extent where Rachel immediately takes – a dislike to the female police officer, but quite likes the male one.
Finds him helpful and
wanting to help her and intelligent. And whereas the woman Riley, she's just awful. She's out to get me. You know, it is this like knee jerk dynamic that the women just hate each other on sight. You know, unless we develop a reason to like each other, our default stance is you're a woman, fucking hate you.
I was just listening.
Give me a reason not to.
I was just listening to Megan Abbott in the car, whose new book is coming out.
Yeah,
she was on the New York Times book review. Podcast. And she was talking about thrillers and she said that, you know, because the question was asked for her about the dark stuff she writes about. And she says that she sees thrillers as a safe space to discuss troubling issues.
Mm.
And I thought about this book. Is this book being a safe space to discuss women's hatred for each other? I don't know.
But I don't think it does that, though. And anyway, so look, let's get to the ending, because this is where it's...
Wait, finish the point. No, what you were going to say. What, you don't think it does that?
Well, I don't think it does discuss women's hatred. It's just it's part of the mechanics of the book, it's taken as a given, and there's not at any point where any of the characters...
All right, okay, but on that, before we get to the ending, I noticed that people give it one star on Goodreads, so, well, Rachel is such an unlikable character, which she is, but the problem isn't with Rachel on her own, it's that interaction with everyone else.
Do you know what? I don't like...
We loved Claire Massoud's book, The Woman Upstairs, which has an very unlikable narrator in many ways, but...
Yeah.
Has an interesting exploration of relationships between women and women.
And here's the thing. I've decided I really hate the term unlikable character, not only because almost all the time you have to insert that little invisible word between the two, which is female, unlikable female character. And the reason you have to insert it is because it's almost never a male character, so you don't have to say it.
Oh, I don't know about that. There are a lot of books I've read recently.
But no one who talks about, I didn't like it because the male character was so unlikable. Well, right? It's not a thing.
Okay.
Okay. Overall, there might be exceptions, but it's not a thing, right? You don't hear about people talking about unlikable male characters.
No, there's often this view, and in fact, that Claire Massoud is a good example, where she was pilloried because how can you write about angry women? Why would you even bother? Yeah. Yes, right? No, true.
So anyway, but I don't like the phrase unlikable character because we're not actually talking about liking a character. We're talking about Rachel or, and I honestly cannot remember her name, the woman in Claire Massoud's book. We're talking about those being unlikable people, and that's fine. But a character has no inherent personhood for you to develop a relationship with. And when you talk about an unlikable character, you're talking about engagement with that character. So what that talks about then is something I think that's quite in opposition to the general conversation, which is this person is not someone I would like and want to be friends with or even hang around with too much in real life. And that's fine. That doesn't make them an unlikable character. It makes them an unlikable person. Yeah. Whether or not you then find the character of this unlikable person engaging in the narrative is a different discussion. That doesn't seem to be the one that is had around that term. So that's my soapbox issue for this podcast. But anyway, I actually didn't think Rachel in her current situation was a person you'd like to hang around with. I didn't think she was an unlikable person. Like, I think outside of her current situation, if she could get herself off the alcohol.
I don't think we get enough of Rachel outside the alcoholism for me to make a
But I think that's situational. Like, for me it was quite – yeah, I don't know who she is, but I'm not going to blanket say, oh, she's an unlikable person because she has, a disease.
But I'd say that all three of them. All three of them, they're so – whatever their peccadillo is in this book, it's such a front and center of their characters that you don't see Anna outside of – she must have been a really fun girl, put that in quotes, when Tom was courting her, because there's this hint that they were spontaneous.
Yeah, you get like a gloss over that, but yeah.
But you don't get Anna beyond more than just, oh, my God, I'm being stalked by this crazy ex-wife. Yeah. That's all you get out of her.
Yeah, yeah. Which I guess is understandable if her perception is. Yeah, I know. This is what I'm
like
saying.
It's like books that are so earnest, they never have a joke in them. I mean, this is what this is. It's
absolutely.
Obsessed with its own issues that it doesn't give these characters any time to breathe beyond their fucking obsessions.
But in a sense, isn't that what the sort of thriller genre is about? It's about obsessive characters, about characters who are just like caught with one thing, and that's the thing that they follow to the end of the book and however it resolves itself. So is it an artifact of the genre?
Yeah, possibly. Because Gone Girl's the same. I mean, those characters.
But you get these characters who have an obsession about something. And you follow that obsession. They follow that obsession and you follow it with them. So you don't get – I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I'm not as well versed in the thriller genre as I probably should be.
Get to the ending.
So anyway, so the ending is that – Rachel goes over to Anna's house and then they're having a conversation. At this point, Anna has found out that she's found the phone. She realizes Tommy's having an affair. She doesn't know who with. And she's thrown the phone onto the railway tracks or across the railway tracks or something because she doesn't want Tom to know she had the phone. So that's kind of that sort of setup, which is important. So Rachel comes over and explains everything and says, look, I've remembered stuff and here's what I think. And I think Tom did it. I think it was Megan because here's what I've remembered. And Anna can't quite believe her at first. And there's this to and fro. And then Tom turns up, right? And then it descends into farce.
It really does.
It really does. And you've got – and Anna, who now knows he's having an affair and he's lied to her because she's put stuff together. She's realised he's lied to her about stuff, not just about having an affair but other things that he lies. And Rachel realises it, Tom. And there's this realisation there. So this is not thrown on Anna out of the blue. She's had a day or so to mull this over and realise that Tom is not the man she thought she married, and that now he's having an affair. So Tom comes home and he kind of struggles with Rachel and sort of I think knocks her on the head or something as she's trying, because he keeps the two women kind of imprisoned in the kitchen by holding the baby. So, you know, Anna's going to stay there obviously, and Rachel will stay. It's quite a sinister little scene the way that's played out, but he just picks up his child to hold, and that action naturally means the women are staying. They're going nowhere.
Yep.
Right? But at some point he puts her down, or Anna takes the baby, and then Rachel decides to run for the door, and Tom grabs her and knocks her over the back of the head, and she goes – and then Tom sends Anna upstairs. Like, Tom, who is this controlling, manipulative, look at all the angles, cover your tracks, sociopath, goes to his wife, just go upstairs with the baby while I take care of this, assuming that when he knows now that Anna knows stuff she isn't meant to know, his control has slipped.
Yeah, it's amazing how shitty Tom is as a sociopath in those.
And yet suddenly it's just like, oh, you just go upstairs. As though that doesn't make sense. But anyway, but Anna does, and she doesn't, like, at that point, she creeps back downstairs and picks up the phone, because I guess, I don't know, she doesn't have her own mobile upstairs in the bedroom or something. That's a bit weird. Anyway, and then I think the line in the book is something like, she then sits on the stairs and listens and waits for the right time to call, like the police, obviously. So what's the right time for Tom to kill Rachel? And you go, okay.
I don't get Anna's motivation.
If that's okay, if that's what her thing is, all right, she's going to wait for Rachel to die, okay. And she hates Rachel, so all right, she'll wait for Tom to kill Rachel because she's worried about Tom, like, still being there. She doesn't really want Tom there, though. So I think the right time maybe is she's going to wait for Tom to kill her, and then she can call the cops and Rachel will be dead and Tom will then be taken away permanently, right?
Maybe.
Whereas if she called the cops now, you know, there'd be his word against hers. He might be able to talk his way. None of this is in the book, I'm assuming, right? He might be able to talk his way around. He will not get imprisoned and he might still be there with her and the
baby.
You're
correct. None of this is in the book.
So that's the assumption I'm kind of making by Anna sitting there waiting for the right time to call the police, which is really cold, but I can kind of get that. She wants Tom out of the picture.
But it'd be nice if Rachel was dead too.
But the only way maybe to do that with her surety is to wait till he kills Rachel, right? So because otherwise it could just be, she's mad, she came over.
Yep.
It doesn't quite work because you still have Anna who could say, here's what happened. But anyway.
There's too much time being spent on this ending.
I know. So, and then, but at some point, you know, Rachel manages to get a corkscrew out of a drawer.
Because he never changed. That's a point that's made in the book.
Nothing's ever been changed.
This is her house.
Is this controlling little aspect but of, I mean, Tom.
It's such a gun on the wall situation.
I know, but anyway.
It's so clumsy. Anyway,
and he drags her out the back because he's obviously not going to kill her in the house because, you know, blood and stuff. So he drags her out to the backyard where he's probably going to kill her, and she manages to get the corkscrew into his neck and, like, do something. And so he goes down, and then Anna comes out and kind of bends down and twists the corkscrew to make sure he's dead.
Except we're not told that until the very end.
We're not told that until the very end.
That she's actually trying to save his life.
Yeah, like Rachel thinks she's trying to take his pulse and whatever.
Yeah,
like that.
But actually,
so, and then they call the cops, and then the two women are just, like, sitting there waiting for the cops to come with the dead husband out in the yard. And what they end up telling the cops, and what apparently, according to the book, is believed by the cops, and we're meant to believe that the cops believe it, is that Rachel came over and I guess there was an altercation, then Tom attacked her and she killed him with the corkscrew in self-defense, and Anna tried to give him CPR and that didn't work and he's just died, and this is kind of the thing. And there's no mention of Megan and there's no mention of any of that. And it's like, why is that your story?
Yeah, why not just
why
say...
Why isn't your story?
Why not
look,
just say
Tom killed Megan.
Yeah. We confronted him with the truth.
Yeah.
He went crazy.
Yeah.
He's now dead.
The phone's over there on the other side of the tracks.
Yeah.
You can
find it. Exactly. You can find it.
I don't understand. Like, it just... And if these two women hated each other so much, why would that be Anna's story?
That's the strength of the book. They find a reason to work together in spite of their hatred to kill Tom. It's a moment female empowerment.
Oh,
that's how I read it as a staunch feminist.
I guess you could.
It's a moment of female empowerment. They've killed the naughty man.
But minutes before, Anna was possibly waiting for Tom to kill Rachel.
Yeah, because women are quixotic type
women.
You
know? It's like, in which case, why wouldn't Anna's story be,
I just said something sexist and you ignored it.
I know. But why wouldn't Anna's story be that, oh, no, Rachel came over mad as usual, accusing stuff as usual, and Tom, was right, and then she killed Tom, and I tried, why wouldn't, before she was quite happy for Rachel
by
to be killed.
By the time I got to that stage in the book, I wasn't skimming, I was reading, but It was just words to me at that point.
The ending was just farcical. It really was. It was so over the top, and it didn't have to be, because Tom didn't have to be a sociopath. You know,
He could have just done it as, but you see, he has to be, because if he's not a sociopath.
You can't have the story, can you? Because you can't have this mysterious man who's really nice.
He would be.
Yeah.
He'd be more nervous. There would be
That's
more
That's what
tells.
I mean. He has to be a sociopath for the story to work. For him to be hidden, the only way is for him to be a sociopath.
Exactly. But as a sociopath in that finale, he is shit.
He's
Dexter. Let me tell you right here.
He's so shit. He's no Ted Bundy. That ending, the whole contrived operatic sort of structure of that ending just.
Can I ask a question? Why has he kept the fucking phone? It's not that hard to destroy a burner phone. They're not exactly made out of titanium.
No, but I mean, look.
Why?
People
no.
keep things as souvenirs.
We just said he's a sociopath who's lurking all the
sociopaths
angles.
Sociopaths keep souvenirs.
Oh, fuck me.
People, men who kill women keep bits of the women.
It's the thing that kept up in my head. Just twist the phone up.
Yeah. Look, I don't buy that he would have cared about the phone, not having cared about Megan.
He didn't care about the phone. The phone was at the bottom of his fucking
bag. That's what I mean. I don't buy that the phone would have had such symbolic significance for him, considering that Megan was the one who broke off the thing. It's not like she was a conquest anymore. I don't understand. As you say, I don't understand why the phone had such significance.
And in fact,
that he kept
it was worse because it allowed her to contact
him. Especially once she died. Especially once he killed her.
So,
why not get? No, but especially once he killed her, why not get rid of the phone?
Oh, look, this so.
This
book is so dreadful on so many levels. It's hard. It's actually hard to read at times because of the hatred. And I get the feeling.
Yeah.
That, I know. Is Hawkins trying to be subversive to show that women could be bitches too or something? I don't know.
I don't think that's subversive. I think that's a cultural narrative that we all pretty much buy into. And I think the automatic – I mean, and, in this book you can go, okay, you can point at Tom. And you go, well, Tom was manipulating both of those women so that they would hate each other. You know, he was exaggerating the amount of times that Rachel rang him, for instance, because a lot of those times it was Megan organising, a little tete-a-tete. He was, telling Rachel stuff about Anna that wasn't true. So Tom was kind of orchestrating that acrimonious relationship to a certain extent, which started off in a very organic way by a wife who, has a mistress who then marries her husband, and, of course, there's going to be animosity there from the get-go. Yeah. But, I don't know. I thought the ending was way too rushed.
The psychiatrist
way too convoluted.
Is an odd character as well.
He's just.
But he's just, again, he's a red herring. So
he's
given
to be
no,
a red herring.
He's
yeah.
given no develop. Oh, anyway, no. Whatever. I don't want to talk about this book anymore.
So yeah, no.
I'm gonna give it 5 stars on Goodreads.
Do you know what? Also, I'm sick of, as what? I said at the very,
oh,
very
the girl,
beginning, the girl word.
It's a girl on the train, not a woman.
But the thing is, every other point in this book, except for the points where she talks about herself as the girl on the train, she's a woman. She talks about herself as a woman. You know, a woman in her 30s, a woman in my position, and she talks about the other women as women. But
on the train,
she's the girl on the train.
She's a girl.
Do you know why she's the girl on the train? Snazzier title than the woman on the train, and it shouldn't be. No, I'm just sick of it. I'm sick of, the girl with the dragon tattoo, Gone Girl, girl on the train, all the other girl stuff. They're not girls. They're women. They're women on the fucking train. They're women with the dragon tattoo. They're women who are gone. And less of them as well. More present women. And women who like other women, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, so if you
can we have more of that, please?
Yeah. If you're looking for a book which has lots of female collaboration.
Not this one.
Definitely. Oh, except for the end. If you just read the end and even,
And it was the same with Gone Girl to an extent. Like, the women did hate each other in Gone Girl. There weren't that many of the women, but they did immediately dislike each other.
We did have issues with Gone Girl, but we definitely liked it more. Because it's actually better written
I think
as
the,
well.
The
on a
book
sentence
is better
by sentence,
the book
better
is better written, I think. Although, look, I mean.
Because you said it yourself before and we've glossed over it. All the first persons sound the same. Rachel, Anna, and Megan. Megan's got a slight.
To begin with, she does, but it melds.
They may as well be the same person.
Because honestly, I'm not, when I read, I'm very. I guess I'm very bad at not reading titles and stuff.
And each chapter is Rachel, Anna, Megan.
And that's the title. And often I'd be like a page or a half down because they do alternate, but they don't always alternate.
No, that's right.
You do often get two or three chapters in sequence that are from the same narration
correct.
Voice. So you're not always expecting new chapter, new character.
Correct.
And as I said, I'm bad at just flicking over the, you know, the titles and dates, even with All the Light We Cannot See. Sometimes I had to remember to go back and look at the date. But to that book's credit, you did realise pretty much at the beginning of a new section that we're no longer in the same time. did that quite well. This does not do this well with the voices, because sometimes I'd be a page and a half down reading the character's first-person narrative and there'd be something that said something, went, oh, this isn't Rachel. Oh, let me go back. Oh,
problem.
This is Megan.
No, so I had it with voices, Rachel and Anna. I thought
the voices are not distinct, I don't think.
Yeah,
it's especially as they go on, I think she's made, when she's begun each character, there's a small effort made to distinguish them, but that I think melds by the end. And I don't know whether that's something that the book is meant to be saying, but it just meant for a very confusing reading experience at several points. And yeah, if you're going to do first person narratives, I think you really have to work to make them distinct. You can get away with it a lot more in third person. Can't really get away with it in first person because people think in different ways. They construct their sentences in different ways. They use different words. They, you know, it's you need to make that voice, I think, distinctive.
And on another note, and this could – I don't really want to speak another 20 minutes about this book. And it might be just me, or maybe I'm just too politically correct, but there seems to be this odd body-shaming thing going on with Rachel.
Oh, Rachel's so fat and ugly.
Yeah, this constant throughout the book.
Yeah, yeah. I know. It's really –
So you got that and you got it all. It's just one bullet after – it's just one target.
It's
hatred of women hating each other, body-shaming – it's just
and
all the,
and again you kind
and
of
the motherhood
it.
Stuff it's all it's
and,
all
and you look at all that and you go well this is like yes body shaming is a huge issue, so of course Rachel, who's put on weight and of course that will be remarked upon, but there's just and it's difficult in a first person narrative because you're stuck in the character's head, but
it's a cumulative effect of everything else that's in the book.
And there's no kind of and everything else that's in the world.
True.
I mean, there doesn't feel like there is a distancing of that or a critique of that or anything which ameliorates that.
But look, the last 70 years, this is the sign of third wave feminism, because the last 60, 70 years, it's men who have hated each other and ganging up on each other and, you know, killing also people.
Well,
now it's women are getting the chance to do it. So just be...
No women killed another woman in this book.
But that's the subversive element.
Like,
right.
No woman killed or even harmed another woman in this book.
Subversive element.
It's still the men doing the killing and the harming.
But
so there's nothing subversive about that.
It's going to be a book I reread all the time.
Oh,
so,
yes, annually.
Annually. Anyway, can we end this?
We are ending that
because
with that.
When I start putting on my cynical, sarcastic voice.
Two books that
over.
We neither of us really quite love.
Yeah, and this will probably be one of our popular episodes. Anyway, next
Sorry
episode, on a good note, next episode is Patron's
yes.
Choice. Now,
it is.
Kirsten,
this is
before
exciting.
I mention who the winners are.
The winners.
You cannot put, well, the ones that were voted.
Oh, the books, you mean.
You cannot put this up on the show notes. You just have to say, next week is Patreon's Choice.
No,
if you want,
they can know.
No.
Of course they can know.
There's no point to this. If people have already
known
who the winners
are. I don't think everybody reads the show notes.
Put it up, please. Just put the time that we announced it, because people, if they're interested, will go to that. And if they're not, well, they'll find out next month what it was.
Fine. God.
See what I have to do, people? Just to get my
fine.
Way?
It'll be a surprise in the show notes.
Well, it's surprising that they won't. Anyway, next episode is Patron's Choice. Now, do a drum roll now that I've had all that. Is that even going to be picked up on the microphone?
Hope so.
Okay.
Every time you thump the table, it gets picked up, so.
Book one is, can you guess? Oh, you already know.
I wrote that list.
Yeah, you're right. Quicksand House by Carlton Mellick III. I've never read Bizarro Fiction. Well, now I get a chance to.
Okay.
Yes,
I waded into that pool a couple of years ago and waded back out, so I'm quite interested to read this book.
Oh, this is going to be a great podcast. And?
No, I'm genuinely interested. I didn't wade very far.
World Fantasy Award nominated, Bram Stoker Award winning. And a few other things possibly that I haven't thought of. A Head Full of Ghosts by Paul Tremblay.
I'm really looking forward to reading that book. I was so excited that got one of the slots. But actually, I mean, to be fair, we'd kind of scheduled that for later in the year anyway. So
yeah, and just
so we've pulled that forward, and we'll be reading something else later in the year,
which we won't mention.
Which we won't mention yet.
We probably should mention the other books, not now, but on the podcast, the other ones that were nominated.
Yeah, we can mention them.
Yeah, just to say what was there.
Yeah, I can put them in the show notes next month as well so people know.
Okay, good. Anyway.
So they're the two for next month.
So
Quicksand House.
Neither of them are particularly long.
No, which is another good thing. Thank you, patrons. You know my time is short. It was no 250,000 word fantasy epic.
Yes, thank you. And both, look, I'll be honest, I've already two-thirds of the way through the Tremblay.
I'm not. I'd arrived yesterday. I actually bought the physical hard cover.
Well, I'm reading it because it was on the World Fantasy Award ballot.
It's so I'm really excited about reading it.
I won't say anything. I'm just saying I'm two-thirds of the way through.
Okay. Don't say anything.
So by the time people listen to this, I'll have finished it. Anyway, please send feedback commenting on the website. Does anyone actually comment on the website anymore?
No. Probably not.
We do get emails, though, and we might get a few after this episode, although maybe I'm pushing this a bit higher than I think. writerandcritic@gmail.com. So if you are a new listener and you're only listening to this podcast because you love All the Light We Cannot See and The Girl on the Train, and you're now wondering,
where
the fuck are these people and why won't they shut the fuck up, please email us. Or you can follow us at Writer and Critic on Twitter. Or if you're one of those new people who's listening to this because of As Above, you can sponsor us on Patreon because you'll want to support this podcast. And on that positive note, I am done.
I am done too. Just as a side note, I do apologise, listeners, for getting this to you late. As you will know, it won't. It's currently August, not while we're recording, but while you're listening, because July got away from me. But the next episode, I promise you, will be out before the end of August.
Oh yeah, so we've got to figure out dates.
We will. We'll see you again in August. Again, bye. Say goodbye, Ian.
Bye. I thought I did already. I was checking the dates.
No, you were checking the